Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And I'm working through a migraine.
Yes, she is working through a migraine. She's Jean Marie.
Oh, yeah,
collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're talking about ulcers and upper endoscopies with me, Lita.
Hi, Lita.
Hey, Lita.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, I was hoping that I'd
long time listener, first time caller?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes.
Good deal.
So, Lita, can you tell us what actually is an upper endoscopy?
It's not much fun. There's a very small camera, very small, at the end of a very long, flexible tube that allows your doctor to visually examine the upper portion of your digestive system. And you want to know how he gets it there?
How does he get it there, Lita?
Through your mouth.
It's better than the other end one.
Yeah, the other end one, we'll talk about
that.
We'll
get to the butt of that later.
The butt of that one, yeah. That's next week. Yeah, okay. The colonoscopy was from the other end.
Luckily they wash it in between.
It wasn't the same tool. I asked them.
Okay.
Somehow I think we're missing a rim shot here somewhere.
Okay. An upper endoscopy is a procedure used to visually examine your upper digestive system with a tiny camera on the end of a long flexible tube. A specialist in diseases of the digestive system, called a gastroenterologist, uses the endoscopy to diagnose and sometimes treat conditions that affect the esophagus, that's the upper swallowing area, the stomach, where all your food goes, and the beginning of the small intestine, which is called a duodenum.
Duodenum.
Duodenum?
No, it's duodenum.
It depends on what generation you are.
I think I call it duodenum.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure. You can call it whatever you want. That's where your food also goes.
Okay.
But anyway.
Hey, it's your show.
Yeah. It was your innards. I'm sure they're, yeah. So, Lita, why does a doctor suggest that you get an upper endoscopy? Was it just for kicks?
Yeah, doctors are bored. Well, according to the Mayo Clinic, an upper endoscopy is used to diagnose and sometimes treat conditions that affect the upper part of your digestive system, including the esophagus, stomach, and duodenum. Your doctor might recommend the endoscopy procedure to investigate signs and symptoms. An endoscopy may help your doctor determine what's causing digestive signs and symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, difficulty swallowing, gastrointestinal bleeding. They can diagnose, they can use that endoscopy to collect tissue samples, which is called a biopsy, to test for diseases and conditions such as anemia, bleeding, inflammation, diarrhea. They're not going to do an upper endoscopy for diarrhea. All right. Or cancers of the digestive system. They can also use it to treat problems. The doctor can pass special tools through the endoscope, which is that long, flexible tube, to treat problems in your digestive system, such as widening a narrow esophagus, clipping off a polyp, which is a growth, or removing a foreign object, which there were no foreign objects in my esophagus.
That Lego
for
that
all
you
our
swallowed.
Younger listeners out there, look what you have to look forward to as you get older.
Well, or when you're young, if you accidentally swallow like a Lego.
A Lego, yes.
It doesn't pass.
In my case, I was having odd symptoms, so my regular GP had me make an appointment with the gastroenterologist.
So what, you just mentioned some of your symptoms. What were some of the other ones?
Well, my symptoms basically were extreme gas. I can belch or burp like a troll.
I think it's actually more like a Sesame Street character. The da-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na.
There you go.
Yep.
I gave you a sample.
Yeah.
And I never want to eat. I always feel full.
Well, what did they wind up finding during your test?
No Legos. No. It turns out that I have two ulcers, one in the esophagus and in the stomach. another one in the stomach, and I have chronic gastritis. Basically, I have gastroesophageal reflux disease, and nobody says that. They call it GERD, G-E-R-D. Some people also call it acid reflux. Basically, it is a digestive disease characterized by chronic acid reflux, which occurs when the stomach acid, there's acid in your stomach that breaks down food, flows back into your esophagus, so it back flushes up. GERD is a common condition affecting 44% of U.S. adults every month and nearly 18% of U.S. adults every week. People of all ages can be affected by GERD, including children.
And what can you and your physicians do about that?
Well, right now I'm on a proton pump inhibitor, or PPI. PPIs reduce the production of acid in the stomach. They work by irreversibly blocking an enzyme called H plus K plus ATP, ATPase?
ATPase? Yeah, I love the ATP and the whole Krebs cycle thing.
Controls acid production. This enzyme is also known as the proton pump, and it's found in the parietal cells of the stomach wall.
And is that medication working? Is it helping?
What do you think?
Oh my gosh.
You're welcome. You're welcome, listening audience. It started to work after about a week that I was on it, and I felt better for about 2 weeks, but now the belching is returning, and I don't really know what that means, so I'm going to have to call him. But I am seeing him again for a repeat upper GI test in 5 weeks. But I will call it to find out why is the belching returning.
Well, you mentioned GERD. I've actually heard of it before. I think a lot of the listeners have, like you were saying. But really don't know that much about it. What actually causes people to get GERD?
There are several factors that can increase your risk for acid reflux disease or GERD. If you have stomach abnormalities, that's one reason, and that can cause acid reflux disease in the stomach. You could have a hiatal hernia, which is unusual, but it can happen, and that can occur in people of any age. A hiatal hernia happens when the upper part of the stomach and the LES, which is the lower esophageal sphincter, move above the diaphragm. And this is the muscle, the diaphragm is the muscle wall that separates your stomach from your chest. So when it's working correctly, the diaphragm normally helps keep the acid from rising into your esophagus. But if you have a hiatal hernia, it's easier for the acid to move up into your esophagus. Another cause of GERD is pregnancy, which I do not have that problem right
now. I was going to say, am I going to have a little brother or sister soon?
Maybe a little alien. But many women experience acid reflux for the first time during pregnancy, and this is caused by the increasing levels of hormones combined with the pressure from the growing fetus. It's usually worse during the third trimester, and the symptoms almost always disappear right after delivery. Smoking can also contribute to acid reflux disease. I do not smoke. And by doing any of the following, smoking will damage the mucous membranes. They'll impair the muscle reflexes in the throat. They will increase acid secretion. It reduces the LES muscle function. That's that sphincter between the esophagus. And it will reduce salivation, which neutralizes the effects of the acid. Smoking also increases the risk of cancer of the esophagus.
Okay, so we all know your opinion on this is don't smoke.
Don't smoke.
And then I understand that there's also some foods that you should avoid.
Yes.
Like soda pop or other carbonated type beverages.
I gave up carbonated beverages in November.
Chocolate?
Oops.
Okay, I was going to say, I think you were eating that just before we started taping.
Maybe that's where those two burps came from. Okay?
Alcohol?
Very, 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 very little alcohol.
Citrus?
Very little citrus.
A little occasional orange juice, but you're doing the low-acid version.
Yes, I do drink. They do make a low-acid version of orange juice, which I drink.
Fatty or fried foods? Not really.
Not
right?
really.
No. How about coffee or tea?
Oh, tea. I love tea.
She loves her. Yes. She loves her peach tea. Mm-hmm. How about tomato-containing products?
Well, being raised in an Italian family, mm-hmm. spaghetti sauce, pasta, pizza. Yeah, I do like my tomato products.
Garlic?
A little
onions?
Bit of garlic. Onions, no. Maybe that's why I don't like onions.
Maybe.
Onions
How about
don't
mint?
Like me. Mint.
You eat mint. A lot of mints.
Mint?
Oh, yeah. You eat like a handful of mints every hour.
Mint.
You guys talk like you know each other a lot.
Mints. You
yeah.
mean like this one here in my
yeah,
hand?
Yeah, that one there. How about spicy foods?
No. I used to.
Okay.
I used to, but I
right.
don't like spicy
don't do
foods
that anymore.
Okay. Right. Wow.
All right. Well.
So, mint. No. I got to cut out mint and chocolate. And tea.
I don't know where you would be with those at those three.
All
it's
right.
the majority of your food.
Okay. Okay. Well, drinking alcohol also increases the risk of esophageal cancer. The more you drink, the greater the risk. And if it's coupled with smoking, the risk is even greater than either using alcohol or tobacco alone. So don't drink, don't smoke. Reduces your chance of esophageal cancer.
Okay.
Other causes of acid reflux, besides the foods and the pregnancy and the hernia, being overweight or obese, eating a heavy meal, and then laying on your back or bending over at the waist. Why would you do that?
You lay down. Oh, why would you bend over?
Yeah.
Pick up a kid, tie a shoe.
Oh, okay.
Scratch something.
Okay.
Weed.
Don't do that after a heavy meal.
Okay.
I don't eat heavy meals, so I'm safe there anyway.
There you go.
Smoking close to bedtime.
Snacking.
Oh! Snacking. Snacking close to bed. Snacking
wow.
close to bedtime.
Are you drinking now?
No. I'm drinking tea, which I'm not supposed to drink.
Okay.
Snacking close to bedtime or laying down right after
Which
a
you
meal.
Do sometimes,
I
too.
Do, actually, yes.
yes.
Maybe that's part of the problem, too.
It could be.
I have a very, very, very bad lower back, and I lay down whenever I can. So I'm going to have to time that better. Or taking aspirin or ibuprofen. Did I say that right?
I think it's the your swollen tongue that you
okay.
bit. It's kind of fun.
And some muscle relaxers or mm-hmm. certain blood pressure medicines can also cause it.
Okay.
Well, I've got a question, Lita. Earlier you mentioned that it's common, affecting, I think you said 44% of adults each month.
That's a big amount.
Well, is GERD considered serious then?
Well, without intervention. So if you just let it go, don't do anything, and you say, okay, I'm just going to deal with it, you know, just live with it, and don't change your diet, don't get any medicine. If you have a hernia, don't get surgery. Without intervention, 26.5%. Where'd they come up with that number? What an odd number.
Only the bottom half of somebody had the effects.
Yeah. I mean, a half a person.
Okay.
26.5% of chronic GERD patients may develop a precancerous condition called Barrett's esophagus. Other risk factors include, well, we already talked about mm-hmm. the tobacco, the, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Common symptoms of GERD, besides my belching, chronic heartburn. I don't think I've ever had heartburn. I don't.
You've never. Okay, you thought you were having a heart attack because you ate a really big burrito once? I think that was heartburn.
Oh, okay. So that's what heartburn is. Okay. Regurgitation. Throwing up?
Yeah.
Okay. Throwing up could cause it. Chest pain.
No,
or...
these are symptoms.
Oh, symptoms. Oh, I'm sorry. Back on the same sheet
Welcome
of music.
Welcome back to the show, Lita.
Chronic, okay, symptoms, chronic heartburn, regurgitation, chest pain or discomfort, chronic cough, sore throat or hoarseness, sleep disturbances, nighttime symptoms.
Right, so you have this acid crawling up your esophagus. So
yes.
it's burning, it's hurting, it's causing you trouble to sleep, you're sometimes throwing up that acid, it's causing pain, discomfort, heartburn, nausea,
bloating,
yeah,
belching,
yeah.
Intolerance of certain foods.
Right, you'll eat spicy food, and the next thing you know, you are in so much pain.
And a sour taste at the back of the
mouth. Which is the acid.
Oh, okay. All yeah. right. So those are symptoms.
Yes.
Is it serious? Yes. 25%, 26.5% will probably get the precancerous condition called Barrett's esophagus.
If they don't
if they don't treat it. Right. Yes.
Okay.
Which actually leads me to my next question. You mentioned Barrett's esophagus being a precancerous condition. Well, who is Barrett, and what does his or her esophagus have to do with GERD?
Barrett's esophagus is a precancerous disease. That's just what they call it. Maybe Barrett's the guy that discovered it. Or the girl that discovered it.
We have a crack team of researchers here, folks.
That affects the lining of the esophagus. It occurs when stomach acid and enzymes leak back into the esophagus. And over time, that chronic injury from the acid backwash causes esophagus cells to change. And it's common for a patient with untreated GERD to develop Barrett's esophagus. It's estimated that 95% of Barrett's esophagus patients also have GERD. So yeah, it goes hand in hand.
And then what are some other tests that your doctor might want to run?
There is an esophageal pH test.
Okay.
And that's an outpatient procedure that's performed to measure the pH or the amount of acid that flows into the esophagus from the stomach during a 24-hour period.
How do they find out what your acid level is like in your esophagus?
The test may be performed to evaluate the effectiveness of current treatments for heartburn or reflux. The test is often recommended for those whose symptoms aren't helped by medication. Maybe me.
I was going to say that's next on the list of things you're going to have to do. What are they going to do, Lita?
Well, the equipment used in that test is a small probe. Oh, I'm going to get probed. that is inserted through your nostril and positioned near the lower esophagus. The probe is plugged into a small unit or monitor worn on your belt or over your shoulder. Wow. A newer wireless device may make the monitoring of the pH easier. I think I'll take that one. Instead of having to have the tube placed down your nose for 24 hours, your doctor will place a disposable capsule into your esophagus using an endoscope. I like that better. The capsule may then wirelessly transmit information for up to 48 hours to a receiver worn around your waist.
And then one day it'll get swallowed by a whale.
With the touch of a button on your monitor, it will record the following information: the occurrences of symptoms, the times when you eat and lay down, and then a nurse will review the monitoring instructions with you. Or you may have another test called an esophageal manometry, which is also outpatient, and that identifies problems with movement and pressure in the esophagus that may lead to problems like heartburn.
Right. I was reading online that they can help strengthen your esophagus by, wrapping something around it. And they used to just use your stomach to wrap it around so that the acid would be less likely to go up into your esophagus.
This is why I didn't want to be a guest. I don't think I want to know all
these things. I don't
think
we'll be doing this again, so it's okay.
What do you think, Ron? Are we going to do this again?
I don't know.
Did I lose you? Did I lose you, Ron?
If you're having this much issue with an upper endoscopy, I hate to see what's going to happen with a colonoscopy.
She had the colonoscopy,
I had the
too.
Same day.
And now she's going back for the an upper GI, which is a series of x-rays performed by CT. And that'll be this week.
Yeah. I just thought that maybe the upper endoscopy would be a little bit easier on you than the colonoscopy, but it sounds to me like the other one was easier.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, this was kind of surprising to me. I don't think I want to know any of this. But anyway, moving on. The manometry, yes, we were talking about that. First, let's talk about the esophagus. It's a food pipe leading from your mouth to your stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the manometry measures the strength of the muscle coordination.
Oh, I've had this before.
You have?
Yeah, but it was live. It wasn't like they put something...
You didn't die?
No. I mean, like, you're awake and you're standing up and there are a bunch of people in the room wearing lead aprons.
While you swallow.
Yeah, I've had this several times.
I was there watching you. That one wasn't too bad.
For you, it wasn't too bad. You swallow a lot of odd stuff.
Yeah, crackers, right?
Crackers and cookies. I mean, I wanted to tell him I need like little stuff, like couscous. Couscous gets stuck really badly in my throat.
Yeah.
And then for days, I'm coughing up couscous.
I remember that. Okay. So during that test, a thin pressure-sensitive tube is passed through the nose, along the back of the throat, down the esophagus, and into the stomach. Your esophagus moves the food from your throat down to your stomach with a wave-like motion called peristalsis.
Peristalsis.
That's what I said. Manometry will indicate how well the esophagus can perform peristalsis. Did I say that right? Manometry also allows the doctor to examine the muscular valve that connects the esophagus with the stomach, called the lower esophageal sphincter. We talked about him before. This valve relaxes to allow food and liquid to enter the stomach, but then it closes again to prevent food and liquid from moving out of the stomach and back into the esophagus.
Right, so if that sphincter isn't working properly, that's when they can wrap something around the lower part of your esophagus to try to just give it an extra...
Squeeze,
yeah.
Okay. Abnormalities with peristalsis or the sphincter function may cause symptoms such as swallowing difficulty, like Jean's got, heartburn, which I guess I have when I eat burritos.
Burritos the size of your head.
It was a big burrito. I loved that. It was a good burrito. Okay. Or chest pain. Yeah, that's why I went to the hospital, because I thought I was having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Information obtained from the manometry may also help doctors to identify the problem. The information is also very important for surgery to treat reflux.
Well, Lita, are there any risks involved with having this procedure?
No.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
With any procedure that you're going to be having, there are always inherent risks and the possibility for complications.
Oh, like bleeding?
Yeah. Somebody sneezes when they're trying to do something, you know.
That's never good.
No.
Okay. Or if they don't clean the equipment and you end up with
bleeding,
an infection.
Yeah, infection.
Bleeding. Mm-hmm. What other problems?
I believe that you could have tearing.
Like if they push the pipe the wrong way and rip it?
Yeah, or, you know, something just happens and, yeah.
Okay. Or reaction to sedation, which I have every time I get sedated. I get nauseous.
Or really goofy with a oral sedation due to THC.
All right.
So what can we do about that?
To reduce the risk of complications, mm-hmm. follow your doctor's instructions to the letter.
Okay, for example...
fasting, stopping mm-hmm. certain medications, they would both help.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there are some things to be concerned with, but it's not that bad.
It's like typical, whatever, you know, when you sign one of those waivers when you go to the hospital, you know, the risk of this, and this. It's all typical stuff.
So medication or surgery, is that the way to resolve the problem?
Medications that help GERD include antacids, which I've taken so many bottles of Tums and Prilosec and...
Milanta
and...
Milcom and magnesia.
Yeah, I've taken all of that. H2 blockers, which I don't think I've ever taken an H2 blocker. And the proton pump inhibitor, which I'm on now. But unfortunately, some people aren't helped with medication or lifestyle changes. Like I don't smoke, but I did give up carbonated drinks, and that didn't help. And I don't know if I'm going to give up chocolate. Surgery may be an option for those people. Surgery focuses on repairing or replacing the valve, that sphincter thing that's at the bottom of your esophagus that normally keeps the acid from moving backward. So that could be an option.
Okay. And what exactly is an ulcer?
It's an open sore on an external or internal surface of the body. So you can get a skin ulcer, or you can get an ulcer in your stomach or your esophagus caused by a break in the skin or a mucous membrane, and it fails to heal.
Well, that certainly is a mouthful of all the information that you discussed in this show. Are there any additional tips or hints or any advice that you might have for someone recently diagnosed with ulcers?
Well, everybody knows their own body. You know, if you have sudden symptoms of something different that you're not used to. You know, like all of a sudden you start belching like a troll, talk to your doctor or a Muppet. So just talk to your doctor if you have any symptoms.
Okay. Well, Lita.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining your show.
Oh, I bet I'll do this again real soon. I make a lousy guest.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, how can our listeners learn more about you?
They could go to our website. They could go to Weagle Health, where we're up for several awards, or the People's Choice, where we're up for an award. Or they can email me at podcastdx@yahoo.com.
Or follow you on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
Pinterest,
I'm also on Facebook.
Twitter or Instagram.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
What about Pinterest?
Yep.
Pinterest too.
Yep.
Podcast DX at all of the above.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review based on all of our episodes and not this one alone. Wherever you get your podcast, as always, please keep in mind that this podcast is definitely not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice or diagnosis or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or their qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime, and never disregard medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast.
Till next week.